Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I'm proud to say that a man who has devoted his entire professional life to protecting the country we love in a variety of very distinguished capacities is a good friend of mine, and a man we're going to be privileged to speak to for this full hour. His name is the Honorable Robert Joseph. He has been, among other things, an Undersecretary of State. He has been a Senior Director on the National Security Council with responsibility for the defense portfolio. He's been an ambassador as the representative of the United States to something that is called the Standing Consultative Commission. He's held positions in the Defense Department as well as the NSC and the State Department, and he is an extraordinary public servant, now back in the private sector, a teacher, contributor to the public policy debate through his published writings. And I'm always delighted to be able to catch up with Bob, especially to do so at length. And we're going to do that just right now. Thank you, Robert Joseph. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate the kind introduction and the invitation to join you today. I look forward the discussion.
As do I. Bob, you've spent a lot of your time worrying about the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, notably in the hands of very dangerous regimes. I'd like to start with one that has been very aggressively building up its nuclear capabilities in recent years, and that would be the Democratic Republic, People's Republic, I guess it is, of Korea. That would be the North Korean regime, now under the third generation of the Kim dynasty, Kim Jong-un. Talk a little bit about what you make of the kind of buildup that's taking place there and the continued brandishing of these weapons and threats involving them by this despotic regime.
Kim Jong-un has, in recent days, been making more and more headlines about building up his nuclear capability, using words such as exponentially expanding the a number of nuclear weapons in the North Korean arsenal, the diversity of those weapons, and the weapons that deliver nuclear warheads, including long-range ICBM-class weapons that can hold American cities hostage to nuclear destruction. We've watched over the course of the last 30 years the growth of the North Korean arsenal, starting at 1 to 2 nuclear weapons, then 30 to 40, 60 to 80 today. There's a RAND study out that postulates that by 2027, North Korea could have over 200 nuclear weapons, more than the British, more than the French. And just imagine what North Korea can do with 200 nuclear weapons. They can diversify the delivery platforms and provide the different services with nuclear weapons, which is something that Kim Jong-un has called for. They can provide nuclear weapons to other rogue states. And of course, given North Korea's propensity to sell whatever they have for cash, they could sell nuclear weapons to terrorist organizations. And we're woefully unprepared for any of those alternative scenarios.
Yeah. And I guess the thing about it is that even if those nuclear weapons are just under its own control, let alone some of the other bad actors that you've mentioned, Bob, that's a problem in its own right. And as you say, they're talking about exponentially building it up, but they're also talking about using those weapons, notably against the South Koreans and against us. You know, I think a lot of people in our line of work have kind of discounted those threats. It's the kind of bravado that the Kim dynasty has exhibited from its founding. Should we be taking it seriously under present circumstances, though?
Well, I think we have to. And I would say the bravado is not just on the North Korean side. It's also on our side when we discount the threat and we say, well, if North Korea were ever to use a nuclear weapon, it would be suicide. We would turn their country into glass. Well, I don't think it works that way. And if you sort of look at how they might use nuclear weapons, both to deter us from coming to the assistance of our ally, South Korea, in the context of an attack by the North. And remember, that is their policy, to reunify the peninsula by force if necessary. Would we use nuclear weapons if they used it only to threaten or hold, as I say, our cities hostage? I doubt that. Would we use them? Would we use nuclear weapons against North Korea if they were to use chemical and biological weapons, of which they have massive amounts? I don't think we have conceived of the threat and conceptualized the threat in a way that is in our best interest. We do need to deter them. How do we deter them? Well, we need to have a credible nuclear capability of our own, which in many instances is lacking, particularly in this zone of theater nuclear weapons, which you are very familiar with, Frank. But we also have to have an effective missile defense. And there, even though we have been toying with a defense against so-called rogue states in terms of intercepting their incoming missiles, we have not made very much progress. We have held ourselves back from deploying an effective capability, because this is not the threat of 20 years ago, when we had the original basing for our ballistic missile defense. This is a much more sophisticated threat, and we have not kept up with that threat, either on the offensive sort of nuclear side or the defensive ballistic missile protection side.
Right. We're going to drill down on both of those points, Bob. We've got to take a break here in a moment, but let me just say, one of your signal contributions, as I recall, to our security, and there are many, was during your service with the George W. Bush administration, helping that president extricate ourselves from a legacy arms control agreement of a previous era, the Soviet-U.S. Cold War, called the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that essentially precluded us from having missile defense of any real capability. But as you say, Bob, one of the things that was done as a kind of, accommodation, I guess, to those who were horrified that we were getting out of that treaty and contemplating having missile defenses, was we would keep them very confined. We would have essentially just the capability to contend with, rogue states like North Korea and Iran, I think specifically. And what you're telling us is that we didn't even really do that very well in terms of deployed missile defense capability, sir?
Well, yes, I am saying that. Go back to extricating ourselves from the ABM treaty in 2001, 2002. We pushed, after leaving that treaty, in accordance with the terms of that treaty, we pushed for a deployment, and we had initial deployment in October of 2004.
I have to ask you to hold. This is a story that I don't want to cut short, but I have to take a pause. Okay. We'll be right back with more with the Honorable Robert Joseph, a longtime member of the United States Defense and State Departments and National Security Council, right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Joe Biden renewed his attacks on millions of us seeking to make America great again, reprising themes from last year's ominous Independence Hall speech. The president declared the MAGA movement, quote, does not share the basic beliefs in our democracy and would fundamentally alter the institutions of American democracy as we know it, unquote. Such vilification was accompanied by a hearty perennial of leftist demagogues, namely accusing others of what they themselves are doing. Notably, Team Biden's fundamental transformation of the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security, the FBI, the intelligence community, and the military threaten our constitutional republic far more than those who seek to restore limited accountable government firmly rooted in the Bill of Rights. Joe Biden's venomous rhetoric portends further weaponization of the government's power to crush his political opponents, all in the name of defending democracy. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with one of the smartest guys I know, certainly a man of great experience at the highest levels of our government, on a whole host of issues that are of great relevance to our security today, not just in the past. And Bob, I hated to cut you off, but Dr. Robert Joseph is our guest. You were beginning a story about what we did in connection with withdrawing from the anti-ballistic missile treaty and the kind of missile defenses that we set our sights on having and what we actually have at the moment instead. Back to that story.
In June of 2002, we officially left the treaty, as I said, in accordance with the terms of the treaty. We then began to develop and hit initial operational capability of a rather rudimentary system, ground-based interceptors in Alaska and four in California, that could protect against handfuls of missiles, a limited threat, particularly from North Korea. The threat has changed dramatically since 2004. It's been almost 20 years. And the North Korean threat itself has outpaced the improvements that we have made to our missile defense system. And I think even for North Korea, not including Iran, not including China and Russia, we are undercutting our ability to defend our own cities and in turn to deter the use of nuclear weapons against the United States. And I think today, as you look at the threat, you have not only North Korea on steroids in terms of the threat from 20 years ago, but you also have Iran, a threshold nuclear weapon state. I mean, let's call it for what it is. And Iran, of course, has been launching satellites using the same technology that one would use in intercontinental ballistic missiles. So they're a short way away from being able to threaten American cities. And then, of course, you have Russia and the coercive threats that Russia has been making over Ukraine and in other contexts. I mean, Putin has often used sort of the specter of a nuclear, using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And you look at Russian military doctrine, it's not just Putin making verbal threats. Their doctrine has changed. Their doctrine has emphasized nuclear weapons. Their doctrine has emphasized getting a capability to dominate escalation in a context of a conflict with the West. And China has embarked on this rampant, called breathtaking by a former strategic command commander, breathtaking buildup of its nuclear capabilities. And in fact, today has more ICBM launchers than the United States. So if you look at how the threat has changed, and you look at these almost incremental, at best, changes that we've made to our ability to protect against this threat, we're in a position where we have to have a fundamental shift in how we think about missile defense and the type of capabilities that we need. And when I say Russia and China, I need to be very clear, this is not about a major first strike. This is not about thousands of nuclear weapons being used against us. This is about the coercive type of threats that they use in Ukraine, as I said, with Russia, and not far behind that is the type of threats that the Chinese will make with regard to Taiwan. In fact, already are at lower levels.
I want to come back to this whole deterrence concept with you, Bob, both on the nuclear offensive deterrent side as well as the defensive side. But maybe we could just develop a little bit further your thinking on these various other states. I would call them all rogue states, really, given their behavior. But the North Koreans are not alone. In fact, they are very much aligned with, as we saw with the recent visit by train, no less, of Kim Jong-un to see Vladimir Putin in Russia. But with, you know, the Iranians, with the Chinese, for sure, and I think it's fair to say assorted others, the Pakistanis not least, who helped them get into the nuclear weapons business on behalf of the Chinese, as I recall. But let's turn to Iran, if we can, Bob, because I think it's really essential to take stock with you about the ongoing efforts of the Biden administration to fashion deals of various kinds with the Iranian regime, ostensibly for the purposes of keeping them from being a threshold nuclear power, to say nothing of being an incipient nuclear power, to say nothing of actually having nuclear weapons. And my personal assessment is they're probably in that latter category, not just the former two. What is your sense of what the Biden administration and sort of, I call it the Obama-Biden 3.0, the successive Obama administrations have been doing with respect to the Iranians and the kind of, capabilities that are now being put into place in that rogue state as well?
Well, let me just finish up on North Korea and say that we do not have a policy. The Biden administration does not have a policy for dealing with this future of a North Korea with hundreds of nuclear weapons. There are talking points that they use frequently about willing to negotiate denuclearization on the peninsula without any preconditions. And you have an envoy going around the world making the same statement over and over as the arsenal grows. I think we need to recognize that as long as we have the Kim dynasty in place, the threat will only get greater and greater and greater. And so the need is to come up with a strategy that will end the Kim regime. And I think that is clearly through the means of informing the people of North Korea of the conditions in which they live. They do not live in the world's, you know, utopia, which is what they're told 24 hours a day. And the people are going to recognize this. And over time, I think there will be an end to this last of the totalitarian states. And the Kim regime will end, and there will be a unified Korea, which is something that our policy should be seeking, but sorely lacks.
Since you've continued this conversation, sure. I think it's really important to just observe that this is a very different policy than I think has been practiced by U.S. governments under successive presidents. It's always been about trying to engage or trying to prop up the Kim dynasty rather than make common cause with the people of North Korea. And you're absolutely right, Bob. I mean, these people have suffered privation on an incalculable scale. And the idea of giving them the opportunity to enjoy the quality of life that the people of South Korea have long enjoyed should be our goal. And it's not being advanced by a policy of, appeasement, I think it's fair to call it, of this Kim dynasty. And to the extent that it is not working, unfortunately, it is, as you say, only exacerbating the threat that we're currently facing and will in the future. Bob, we have to take another break. We'll be right back with more, and I'll give you a chance to respond, if you care to, on the Korea issue. Okay. And then we're going to insist that we talk a little bit about Iran. We'll be right back with more with the Honorable Robert Joseph, a man of great expertise, a good friend of mine. We're delighted to have him with us for this full hour. So come back for more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Robert Joseph, former Undersecretary of State, is in the House virtually. We're very pleased to have him, as always, for this full hour, most especially filled with insights into the various challenges that we're facing. We've been talking at some length about those from North Korea, a country he's very familiar with, having helped devise strategies and think hard about other solutions to the threat we face from that quarter, which is only growing. And Bob, you had a last comment you wanted to make on North Korea?
Yeah, just very briefly, Frank, you used the word appeasement, and I think that's very apt in this context. With regard to North Korea, I would say that's little appeasement. With regard to Iran, which I know we're coming to, that's appeasement. That's big appeasement. That's appeasement on steroids. With regard to North Korea, I think you're right. I mean, we've been doing the same thing over and over again in terms of calling for negotiations for denuclearization for well over 20 years and expecting a different result. I mean, it clearly fits Einstein's definition of insanity. But that is, I think, the best description of our policy. What we need to do is have a comprehensive strategy, a strategy that, of course, has containment, has an important role for economic instruments to, sanctions and other means of cutting off North Korea from advanced technologies that they can use against us. We have to use all of the instruments of statecraft, as they're called, but we also have to put human rights up front. And that's been sorely lacking. And I think if we do that, and if we do have a influence and information campaign or set of campaigns that tell the North Korean people about life in South Korea, that tell the North Korean people about the abuses of their own government, that tells the North Korean people about the corruption of the Kim regime. I think that's what we need to have in place, and it's sorely lacking.
Well, we don't want to give offense to the regime, that's for sure. And Bob, I guess just in this last thought on North Korea, there are some in the United States Congress at the moment who are toying with this idea that what will really create the breakthrough that we need with the North is to have an end of war agreement of some kind. There's never been a actual peace agreement or declaration. They want to create that now. What are your thoughts on whether that will in fact improve the situation or, as I fear, make it considerably worse?
I don't know that it'll make it considerably worse, but it certainly won't improve anything. It'll be just the next thing that we give away. I mean, really? The North Korean regime is going to change its approach because we sign a piece of paper? I mean, this is a regime that has no, that places no value on treaties, no value on agreements. In fact, they break every agreement that, that they're party to.
Well, I would argue just, the only value is that they get us or their counterparts to engage in appeasement or otherwise disarm makes things
and
worse.
And then we'll come back and give them something else. All the time, their nuclear arsenal is increasing. I mean,
continue to grow. Yeah. The thing I would argue, Bob, that would make this more than just insane is that it is likely to conduce to the idea that if there is peace on the Korean Peninsula, because we have a piece of paper, that we will be told, well, you don't need those American forces there any longer, which will simply, I think, conduce to the next invasion of the South by the North. Let's turn to Iran. The big appeasement, as you put it, that's been underway there, sadly, I think now for decades, certainly the Obama administration in its day was very actively appeasing the Iranian regime. Those doing business as the Biden administration are hard at it as well. The latest example of which, not the worst, I guess, but still bad, is this idea that we can give them $6 billion for five of our hostages they've taken, plus give them properly convicted criminals from Iran in exchange as well. You've studied these guys at length, Bob. You understand how they like most of these totalitarians, this particular version being of the Sharia supremacist stripe, which is not any better than the communist kind. How are they perceiving our behavior, and is it in fact attenuating the danger we face from that quarter, do you think?
Well, let me see. If you put $1.2 billion ahead as the price of taking Americans hostage, that might lead to more hostage taking. I think that's a probable, that's likely a good bet. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what are they going to do with that $6 billion? What did they do with the billions and billions of dollars that they reaped from the 2015 nuclear agreement, the JCPOA? Well, they use it to sponsor international terrorism. They use it to pursue aggression in the region. I mean, they're the largest supporter of, Assad in Syria, and the destructive, the inhumane war that Assad has pursued against his own people. They use it to repress their own people who are seeking a democratic alternative. So yes, we are providing the funds that are, that are being used against our allies and against, the cause of democracy for which we supposedly stand. And all for what?
Bob, one other thing. Yeah, one other thing that I think you mean to include in that list of horribles is we're helping underwrite their nuclear weapons ambitions as well.
I was just coming to that.
You hadn't meant to leave it out. You're just working up to it. Okay, good.
Well, because tell us about that. That goes to your point in terms of the nuclear program. Iran has continued to pursue a nuclear weapon. It was clear in the documents that the Israelis smuggled out of Tehran two or three years ago. And it's also clear in what the IAEA has been allowed to see in Iran. And that is not only enriching to 60%, the uranium to 60%, which is very, very close to what is required for nuclear weapons grade fissile material. But we've also found that there are traces of 85% highly enriched uranium, which is, I would say, nuclear weapons grade. And yet we just kind of ignore that. And we continue down this path of trying to find a concession, a carrot, something that we can give to the Iranians. And we know from experience that one concession leads to demands for greater concessions, and we just follow that path. If we're concerned about proliferation, it's the original sin of allowing Iran to enrich that has motivated the Saudis and others in that region, in the Gulf region, to posture themselves so that they can break out and have a nuclear weapon when Iran does. A lot of this is on us.
I understand. And Bob, I guess I just wanted to take advantage of your expertise in this subject. You talk about 60% and 85%. Essentially, I think it's fair to say they have enough enriched uranium that they can put together nuclear weapons if they want to. The question, I guess, to you, sir, is, are you satisfied they haven't already done that? I mean, to call them a threshold state, which General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, now on his way out the door, professed was an acceptable arrangement for us, as long as they didn't go those next steps. Will we know, Bob, if they haven't already, when they do?
Well, they haven't tested. And the likelihood is we would know if they tested. Okay. The likelihood. It's certainly not an absolute. I call them a virtual nuclear weapon state because I believe they can have a nuclear weapon whenever the supreme leader says, I want a nuclear weapon. They'll be able to deliver it to them.
But my question, I guess, is will we know whether he's already done that or not?
Well, President Biden has said we will know. We will know if he...
I'm not interviewing President Biden. I'm interviewing somebody I respect and who I think has integrity. What do you think, sir?
I think we will not know. We will not know until they want us to know.
So conceivably, that could already have happened. Is that what you're saying?
It could be that they're ready to test. Yeah, absolutely.
But they don't have to test to have a
functional nuclear weapon.
Right.
Conceivably. One of the two types of weapons that we used in 1945. Yeah.
And Bob, we were just talking at length about North Korea. They've been joined at the hips, the Iranians and the North Koreans, including during periods when the North Koreans were testing nuclear weapons. Is it possible that the Iranians have learned what they need to know from those tests without doing one of their own?
Well, they certainly have shared a great deal of information and in fact have purchased from each other various components in the ballistic missile field. There have been reports of Iranians observing North Korean nuclear tests.
Right. And that's a topic to which we'll return. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Robert Joseph on the other side of it to answer that question more fully. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Joe Biden renewed his attacks on millions of us seeking to make America great again. Reprising themes from last year's ominous Independence Hall speech, the president declared the MAGA movement, quote, does not share the basic beliefs in our democracy and would fundamentally alter the institutions of American democracy as we know it, unquote. Such vilification was accompanied by a hearty perennial of leftist demagogues, namely accusing others of what they themselves are doing. Notably, Team Biden's fundamental transformation of the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security, the FBI, the intelligence community, and the military threaten our constitutional republic far more than those who seek to restore limited accountable government firmly rooted in the Bill of Rights. Joe Biden's venomous rhetoric portends further weaponization of the government's power to crush his political opponents, all in the name of defending democracy. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Time flies when you're having fun, and my idea of fun is to talk with Bob Joseph about the state of various problems we're facing around the world. Bob, you were just describing the collaboration between the Iranians and the North Koreans on ballistic missile technology, for example, and there's been evidence, I think, that they've also been sharing insights into nuclear weapons testing as well. So to the point of the moment, which is, are we dealing with an Iran that already has nuclear weapons and just has not chosen to demonstrate it or tell us that they have them, but is nonetheless now no longer a threshold state, but a nuclear weapons state?
Well, I think Iran, as I said, can have a nuclear weapon as soon as the supreme leader calls for it. Whether he has done that or not, I don't think we know. And I don't think we, under normal circumstances, will know. But the important thing is we need to be prudent in terms of our planning and our thinking about deterrence and our thinking more generally about the threat that Iran poses. It's a multifaceted threat, and it's only getting worse. And we are sitting there, you know, calling for them to negotiate on, you know, restoring this fatally flawed nuclear agreement from 2015. It is a policy that I think will lead to very negative consequences. I think, in fact, disaster for us in the region and well beyond the region, starting with non-proliferation, because I think this has already lit the fuse for more proliferation.
Right. And Bob, I assume that you are of the view that just as we should be trying to bring down the North Korean regime rather than propping it up, supporting and enabling the aspirations of the North Korean people to live free, we should be doing the same with respect to Iran?
Well, I think absolutely we should be doing the same. We should be supporting the people that are demonstrating, that are rioting in the streets across Iran and have been since 2019. Our policy has been supportive in words, but in deeds, in the deeds that we, you know, in our actions, we have actually undercut the aspirations of those Iranian people who seek to rid themselves of this religious dictatorship.
Yeah, that oppresses them and threatens us. I mean,
absolutely.
What's wrong with trying to help them do that? Bob, I want to quickly, and as I say, the time has flown by. There are two other looming problems, at least, that we definitely need your ideas on. One is Russia. The other is the Chinese Communist Party. Both of them led by odious regimes, I think against the interest of the peoples involved, but also against ours. How do you see the relationship between the nations that we've just been talking about and these larger superpowers, arguably, that are clearly aligned with them and working, it seems to me, to be to a common purpose, which is to threaten us and perhaps bring us down?
Well, I think the relationships between and among all four of the countries that you mentioned are increasing and are a growing threat to the United States and to our allies in the region. Kim Jong-un goes to Russia last week and meets with Putin where? In a space launch facility. I mean, if that doesn't send a signal that you need to be concerned about, then nothing will, because that to me indicates that the Russians are very much willing to provide, I should say, continue to provide expertise in the ballistic missile field, and I have no doubt in many other fields. There is sort of, you know, this growing relationship among these totalitarian, authoritarian governments. And you see the same thing with Russia and China, and that strategic partnership, which has no bounds, according to President Xi, and I'm sure it doesn't, when it comes to working against the U.S. interest. And also, you know, you have a closer relationship between Russia and Iran and China and North Korea. All of these relationships are expanding in a way that is directed against the United States, against our interests, both at sort of the peer strategic level and also in a regional context, whether it's Northeast Asia or whether it's in the Gulf and more broadly in the Middle East. It's a very concerning trend. And I don't see us as developing a strategy for dealing with that geostrategic problem that is emerging.
Bob, we've got 2 minutes or so to address this very, very weighty question. But going back to what we started with, given all of that, given these relationships, given these ambitions, given the object of their common purpose being to take us down, what should we be doing now with respect to both the modernizing of our nuclear deterrent, giving it additional capabilities that it desperately needs, as well as in terms of missile defense?
Well, I think clearly what we need to do in the offensive sort of nuclear component of our deterrent is to continue the modernization of the triad, the three legs of our strategic capability, whether they be the submarines or the heavy bombers or the ICBM leg. We're moving in that direction. We need to continue that. But we also need to think differently. We need to understand that Russia and China represents a greater threat to us than just Russia. And the limit that we have on numbers in terms of deployable nuclear weapons is based on the Russia relationship, the Russia threat. So when you add China, when you add North Korea, when you add Iran, you've got to think beyond the current level. And we're still stuck in this notion that, you know, we have New START limitations, and the new START treaty only allows 1,550 deployable weapons. That's not enough in today's environment. That was perhaps enough, perhaps, with regard to Russia
back in the day,
10 years ago.
Bob, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with Robert Joseph right after this. We're back. Robert Joseph is still with us. This is our concluding segment. Alas, there is a lot more to talk about, but Bob, I did want to just ask you, what should we be doing with respect to missile defense as part of our deterrent posture at the moment?
Frank, I think it's very clear that if we're going to deal with the threats that we face that we've talked about, in the context of missile defense, what we need to do is go to space, not just for sensors, but with the for the ability to intercept. And that will, I believe, put a real premium on directed energy capabilities, which we've totally ignored for three decades. I believe that if we had gone to space earlier, we could have done so with a fraction of the cost that we've already spent on the system that we have, a system and an approach that cannot keep pace with the threat.
Right. And a missile defense system in space has the potential to do that and do it at a cost-effective basis as well. I couldn't
agree
with
you
on all of that. Yeah. Bob, let me turn lastly to something that we did yesterday. As I said, you've spent much of your professional life in the Pentagon. We had the privilege of working together with you in the Reagan administration, and you went on to a number of other positions, both in DOD and elsewhere, that bear on this question. I fear that we are now in the midst of a concerted effort by enemies within to take down our military, to be using techniques that are right out of the playbook of Mao Zedong and cultural Marxists before and since, to divide and conquer our military by imposing on it things like critical race theory indoctrination and diversity, equity, inclusion requirements and LGBTQ+ agendas and transgender accommodations and climate change is the most serious threat we face, nostrums. And all of this takes the eye off the ball at best, and at worst, it really subverts unit cohesion and meritocracy and good order and discipline and so on. We did a fascinating program yesterday. We called it a telethon. And it was kind of animated by the idea that we need, in light of all of this happening to the U.S. military, now with a number of senior officers embracing all of it, including C.Q. Brown, the man who is replacing Mark Milley as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This requires an intervention, we believe, an intervention with the military on the part of the United States Senate. But frankly, it seems now, given its propensity to simply rubber stamp the approval of guys like C.Q. Brown, an intervention with the United States Senate as well. And I just wanted to commend to this audience this very, very impactful program. It's to be found at saveamericasmilitary.org. And it also gives you a facility to get in touch with your senators and urge them to root out, not further exacerbate, the Marxist takedown of the military. But, and I know you haven't had a chance to see this this program, Bob, but I know you're also deeply knowledgeable about what it takes for our military to be effective. Yes, it's equipment like we've just been talking about, offensive and defensive, but it's also obviously about the character and quality of our personnel and what we want them to be as warriors. Speak to this problem, if you would.
Frank, I think with regard to our military, it's all about the people and the professionalism of our people. And the military institution has always prided itself on being a meritocracy, on not judging people, not judging the members of our military based on their gender, based on race. It's about what they can do to achieve military objectives. And I've, you know, I look forward to viewing the telethon that you had yesterday. I know I'll learn a lot about it. I have seen reports, of course, of this sort of mindset ingrained in certain leaders of the military, in which they are indoctrinating rather than training. They are promoting these agendas of critical race theory, of, you know, gender awareness, this whole LGBT effort. Very, very concerning. And I think, you know, if it's allowed to take over certain elements of our military, we are going to be woefully unprepared for the real threats, not climate change, but the real threats that our military faces. And it is something that I think needs to be looked at and needs to be acted upon.
Well, I couldn't agree more, needless to say. And the hour is late, I think, is the main point, folks. This has been inculcated not just very aggressively by the civilians in the Biden administration, but as I've indicated, I think the previous two Obama-Biden terms as well. And Bob, I think we both know people in the military who were warriors and who were squared away. I remember as one of the high points of my life, working with you and others in the Pentagon when, well, I'm fond of saying when men were men, but when I think patriots and the commitment to the defense of the country was top of mind and the top responsibility. But these days it does seem as though that's not the case. And we're at great peril for the reasons we've been talking about throughout this program, from people who are deadly serious about military and other means of taking us down. And our military must be up to the job of deterring such behavior, as well as contending with it militarily if they must. Bob, we have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say, so much more to visit with you about. I appreciate your time today, and I very much look forward to continuing this conversation at an early moment. In the meantime, thank you for the extraordinary service you've rendered to our country in your previous incarnations in all of these important agencies, as well as that you're rendering these days. And we look forward to continuing the dialogue.
I do as well.
I think we hope to be continuing the dialogue with the rest of you next time, and that until then, you'll go forth and multiply.